us, the show, as well as links to our social media, go to noisefiltershow.com.
We are grateful to our sponsors, including Access Health Louisiana and the End the Epidemic Initiative, who are working to bring equitable health outcomes to everyone they serve. Hope, any last words?
Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. For lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, for the Working Class. I'm your host, Jamie Partridge. Our topic this evening is free trade versus fair trade, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Our guest is Ime Shao, Pacific Northwest Regional Organizer with the Trade Justice Education Fund and Chair of the Jobs with Justice Global Justice Committee. Thank you for joining us, Ime.
Thank you, Jamie. I'm super, super excited to be here.
Great. Well, let's start with an overview of the last 30 years of struggle against neoliberalism and free trade agreements. I remember the early 1990s when we were fighting the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, with Mexico and Canada. Workers' organizations on both sides of the border fought but lost the battle against NAFTA. NAFTA gave a big boost to the penetration of U.S. investment in Mexico, including moving manufacturing and agribusiness across the border, further hollowing out the U.S. Rust Belt and driving Mexican farmers off their lands, sending them in huge ways into the U.S. to work here in farm work and other low-paid occupations. NAFTA was supposed to have labor standards and environmental standards that they were essentially, but they were essentially unenforceable. And then came the World Trade Organization, which included 98% of the world's countries, including China, in a free trade formation. The labor movement mobilized along with environmental movements to disrupt the 1999 World Trade Organization conference the battle in Seattle. I was there. And subsequent ministerials around the world, but the free trade regimen accelerated, offshoring American jobs to low-wage labor havens, sites without human rights or environmental protections. then came the fight against the free trade agreement of the Americas in the early 2000s, which was disrupted by leftist governments in Latin America, especially Venezuela and Brazil. But the U.S. was successful in coming back with the Central American Free Trade Agreement in 2014. Next up was an Asian initiative called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was again defeated by the labor movement and environmental allies. To be clear, these free trade initiatives have come during both Republican and Democratic administrations, and the latest is the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, the IPEF, put forward by the Biden administration. So, Ime, give us an overview of the IPEF and how it's the same as earlier free trade agreements.
Thank you so much for that background, Jamie. Yeah, I think it's really important to remember that when we talk about issues of trade, economic conditions, et cetera, we remember that where we are today is the direct result of all the days, years, and decades before, and what happens today will shape the decades to come. These conditions don't just come out of nowhere, right? So the economic, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, we're calling it IPEF, was announced last May and is currently being negotiated between 14 countries, but more countries may join in the future. So currently, in addition to the US, there's Australia, Brunei, Fiji, India, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. Together, these countries account for about 40% of the global GDP and 28% of the global goods and services trade. So huge potential impact, right? Writing the rules for, writing the economic rules for a massive swath of the world. And for those who remember the TPP, a lot of comparisons have been drawn because many of the IPEF participating countries also participated in the TPP. And here it's really important to note that one of the many reasons why labor rallied against the TPP to begin with was because many of the countries involved were ones where there is rampant union busting, labor rights violations, and even the murder of labor organizers. And so, you know, we've seen with previous free trade agreements that because there is no mechanism to enforce labor standards, as Jamie said, these agreements lead to race to the bottom dynamics that lead to offshoring of jobs to places where workers can be the most exploited as possible for the sake of maximum profit. Another similarity that folks have been drawing is that there is a high level of secrecy surrounding these negotiations. This was a huge issue with the TPP as well. And it's even more heightened now with IPEF, as even Congress is locked out of these negotiations. As it stands currently, IPEF will not actually need a congressional vote to pass. And it's been said that the US will not release any of its proposed texts until 5 years after IPEF is ratified, meaning that the American people will not get to see what's being proposed in our name until 5 years after it comes into effect. And, you know, the Biden administration has said that they really want to create an economy that works for working people and are claiming that IPEF will be a new worker-centered model of trade. We're still waiting to see how IPEF will meaningfully differentiate itself from the traditions of past free trade agreements.
So how is it different? I mean, on the surface anyway, how is it different than past free trade agreements?
Yeah, so there are definitely some differences in terms of process and structure as well as content. The reason why this deal does not require congressional approval is because there are no changes being made to tariffs. And so the argument is that it's not within Congress's purview. As in its name, right, Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, IPEF purports to be a framework for participating countries to be, quote, economically aligned in its four pillars. The first is trade, the second is supply chains, the third is clean energy and infrastructure, and the fourth is tax and anti-corruption. Another difference in the process is that the bulk of IPEF, so three of those four pillars, are being negotiated not by the US Trade Representative, but by the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce historically has been on the side of business rather than labor. So we already have some questions there as well about how worker-centered this model is. And in terms of content, you might notice that some hallmarks of previous free trade agreements are missing from IPEF. One is the investor state dispute settlement, and the other is a public procurement chapter. So for those who don't know, activists fought hard against ISDS for years, and President Biden has made it clear that he does not support ISDS. So, you know, we can reasonably expect that there won't be an ISDS included in IPEF. And this is a great step forward.
Please explain what ICDS is.
Yeah, so ISDS. ISDS Investor State Dispute Settlement. Let me give you an example. In the early 2000s, Mexico tried to adopt a 20% tariff. A tariff is a tax on import-export. So they tried to adopt a tariff on soft drinks containing high fructose corn syrup. And in response, Cargill, a U.S.-based multinational corporation, was actually able to use ISDS to sue under NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And their suit alleged damages to Cargill's investment in the high fructose corn industry in Mexico. And because of that, Mexico ended up having to pay out $77 million to Cargill. And of course, when we say Mexico had to pay, we really mean the Mexican people whose tax dollars paid the fine and whose health also pays the price for the high fructose corn syrup industry, right? So that gives you a picture of what ISDS does, how it functions. And so the exclusion of ISDS from IPEF is one of the positive deviations from traditional free trade agreements.
And investor state dispute. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Yeah, it means that it's the corporations and their lawyers that make these decisions rather than some impartial judicial body, right?
Yeah, well, so they so there are a couple of avenues to pursue a dispute settlement. But yeah, these settlements are settled outside of domestic courts. So this suit is not being filed in Mexico, for example, but settled outside in like a trade tribunal, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
And what is the the public procurement, the change in language around public procurement?
So there actually isn't change in language. There is just simply an absence of a public procurement chapter. Yeah. So nothing to really go on there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean, that there's nothing about public procurement?
Public procurement refers to things like Buy America or Buy Local and things like that.
So there's no exclusion of those things,
mm-hmm.
like there are in other trade agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, got it. So what are the specific demands that the Trade Justice Education Fund, your organization, are making of the Biden administration with regard to labor rights and human rights in this?
Yeah, so one of our primary demands is for strong labor standards based on the ILO conventions and for participating countries to adopt
them. For people that don't know,
oh, yeah.
The ILO is?
The ILO is the International Labor Organization that's been around since the early 1900s. Yeah, so they have a set of conventions that we're asking countries to adopt before the U.S. signs any IPEF agreement. You know, we are asking also for the ongoing facility-specific enforcement mechanisms so that independent labor movements at least have some leverage to then enforce those commitments, those ILO convention commitments, right? So what are those enforcement mechanisms? Those would be dispute settlement mechanisms so that workers have an avenue to enforce their rights to freely associate and collectively bargain. So in summary, you know, we really want to raise the labor standards and working conditions of every country that the US seeks to make any kind of trade deal with, and to see to it that those standards are able to be enforced. This would also, you know, I really want to remark that this would also protect our labor rights and power to fight for improved conditions domestically, right? Because just as, you know, within the U.S., union standards raise the standards for all workers, regardless of union membership, improving standards internationally will also improve the conditions for labor here as well.
Right. And is there any particular standard for human rights that's built into what you're demanding?
Yeah. So the ILO conventions definitely include standards that we would consider human rights standards as well. Yeah, the reason why I'm not referencing specific ones is because you can go to the website and see all of them, and there's a ton, and it's really comprehensive, and that's why we're advocating for the standards based on these conventions. But we're definitely concerned, right, about the human rights abuses that have been related to, inextricable from, labor rights abuses in some of these countries. And that's why we're asking for the adoption of these standards to make sure, right, we want to avoid more of the same of those race to the bottom dynamics that we described earlier, in which workers can be maximally exploited. So we want to avoid that and make sure that ahead of time, before we make these agreements, that these standards are agreed to and enforceable.
And so what about environmental protections and climate provisions? What are you demanding of the Biden administration?
Yeah. So we already talked a little bit about ISDS. So we should also talk about how ISDS has been commonly used by corporations to sue countries over climate policies as well, right? Not just these like food regulations and things like that. So right now, I think the number is upwards of 1,100 lawsuits in just the past decade alone. So really commonly used. And we think it's great that ISDS is being excluded from IPEF, but exclusion of ISDS is not enough. There are corporations who have lobbied nations to sue on their behalf, and also nations that have filed suits independently of these corporations, right? And ISDS is exclusively like a mechanism for corporations to sue nations. So without ISDS, great, one avenue is cut off, but there are still all these other avenues. And so, for example, the U.S. Recently filed a lawsuit against India for incentivizing local solar production. So India wants to bring solar production home. The U.S. says this is a violation of our trade agreement, claiming discriminatory practice. So this is just one of many examples where trade agreements have been used to prevent countries from enacting progressive climate policy. We're asking for a climate peace clause, and a climate peace clause would put a moratorium on the use of trade and investment agreements to challenge policies that are directly related to achieving climate goals. We are also asking that IPEF include binding enforceable climate standards. I want to point out that also that previous free trade agreements shied away from even saying the words climate change or climate crisis. So it's really interesting that there's an entire pillar of IPEF dedicated to clean energy and infrastructure. Although again, this pillar is being negotiated by the Chamber of Commerce. And so that should give us pause. And it's incredibly important that environmental organizations and advocates get involved early right now to help shape that pillar, so it doesn't end up being another corporate greenwashing tool, right? It's really important that we don't let green energy and infrastructure become yet another site for resource and labor exploitation under the guise of really nice sounding things like clean energy and sustainability. The climate crisis, right, should not be used for corporate gain, and progressive climate policy should not be seen as a barrier to trade. So that's the fundamental belief driving our ask for a climate peace clause.
If you've just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We're listening to Ime Chow of the Trade Justice Education Fund. If you haven't yet contributed to KBOO, we are listener-supported, non-corporate radio. Go to the website, kboo.fm, and make a donation. All right. So we know that the Biden administration is continuing the Trump policies of raising tariffs and trade barriers with China. This IPEF is clearly aimed at hurting the Chinese economy by drawing Indo-Pacific countries closer to the U.S. China's excluded. And tech is a big part of this agreement, and barriers against the export of computer chips to China have just been implemented by Biden. So what is your organization demanding of Biden with regard to digital trade?
So the first part of your question regarding computer chips is a really difficult one. I know that many people in Oregon are excited about the potential revitalization of the manufacturing industry that is tied to that. To me, in this conversation, the way this question most directly relates to the IPEF question is regarding supply chains. So the White House's official memo about this computer chips, actually semiconductors, points out that East Asia is responsible for 75% of the global production of semiconductors, whereas the US is only responsible for 10%. One of the reasons why this is true is because the greatest concentration of an essential material for these semiconductors, rare earth elements or rare earth metals, are found in Asia. And I also want to, you know, say for folks who are like, what are semiconductors? Semiconductors are necessary for, you know, basically everything, ranging from consumer products like cars and other electronics to medical equipment and also weapons. And, you know, because of this, we have, you know, U.S. Senator Cornyn, a Texas Republican, has recently said that semiconductors are the new oil. And, you know, how does this tie to IPEF? One of the four pillars of IPEF is the supply chain. And we could say with, you know, this overlap, the U.S. could possibly conceivably use IPEF to secure these resources, these rare earth metals and semiconductors. And, you know, there's a lot to think about here, you know, given what we know about the history of American campaigns for oil, the comparisons presently being made by our politicians, and also these geopolitical conditions that you're describing. You know, we should carefully consider all of these pieces and ultimately what all of this will mean for working people in the long run and the environment and so on. But your ultimate question, though, was about digital trade. And as a clarification, digital trade refers to data, not hardware like computer chips. So when we talk about digital trade, we're talking about rules about how our data is stored, where it can be moved, and who has access to it. So digital trade rules are ones that would affect data privacy, digital jobs, and you can imagine digital jobs span so much now, right? We do like online banking, we have like online doctor's visits. There's so many digital jobs. So digital jobs, as well as surveillance technology, as well as a category of technology we're calling like bossware, right? Like managerial software. People are using algorithms to decide their like hiring, firing, promotion scheduling, et cetera. AI technology, right? That is included in bossware and elsewhere, et cetera. So those kinds of things are what we are referring to when we say digital trade. And with digital trade, we have concerns that big tech companies like Amazon and Google are trying to use IPEF to push a digital trade agenda to expand their monopoly power and block new consumer privacy rules, block algorithm transparency, lower gig economy worker protections, and also roll back antitrust laws. And this is not just, you know, the boogeyman, you know, that we're making up. We know this because we've seen the official public comments that their lobbyists have given to trade negotiators. And we have also seen the way they try to push the same agenda with the TPP, with the USMCA, past trade agreements, right? Really important to hold those in mind as we move forward. So, you know, what does that all mean for, you know, regular people? Essentially, it means lowering barriers for companies to move our data however they want, and to move jobs consequently however they want, right? And they want to make it easier to union bust and make it more difficult to hide tech-driven labor abuses under the guise of trade secrets, right? Trade secrets means anything that like has a source code that has been produced by this company can be covered under the guise of trade secrets, meaning it makes it very difficult for a third party to go and investigate a potential abuse because they would say, well, you know, this is our proprietary information, this is our trade secret. So just creating more barriers for investigation of abuse. And corporations already have various tools at their disposal to accomplish these things. So for example, in Colombia, Uber, the rideshare app that we all know, used the Colombia Free Trade Agreement to argue that they're not actually a cab company, but rather a telecommunications platform. They said, we just are a chatting app.
right? So they said, why do we have to pay into Colombia's equivalent of Social Security? Why do we have to meet these other legal requirements for cab drivers? Why do we have to meet these worker protections, right? We're a telecommunications platform. And so as you can probably tell, right, digital free trade even has the potential to create a new frontier of exploited workers everywhere. And this is a threat also to the labor movement everywhere.
Got it. So what impact would IPEF have on small family farms, and what are the demands that you're making of the Biden administration with regard to agriculture?
This is a really great question, and one that I'm personally really passionate about. We know that previous free trade deals like NAFTA had devastating effects on farmers in Mexico. Wages dropped to a third of what they were before NAFTA, and 2 million Mexican farmers lost their livelihoods, right? So imagine, for example, you were making, let's say generously, $12 an hour, and now you're making $4 an hour because huge multinational corporations are undercutting your industry. How are you supposed to survive that? And actually in Oregon, we don't even have to imagine that hard, because at least 14% of small farms in Oregon have disappeared since NAFTA. So this is something that we have felt as well here locally. And because of this, we're asking that any agricultural provisions in IPEF should allow for the creation of strategic food and grain reserves and other public investment in agricultural resilience, and in particular, local food systems, right? And IPEF should also include measures to stop land grabs and protect the human rights of farmers and farm workers. And finally, IPEF should set high standards for food safety, and as well as fair price measures for both producers and consumers.
And transparency and participation are key to your demands for fair trade in IPEF. What do you mean by that, transparency and participation?
Yeah. So this one's really quite simple. A worker-centered trade model should center workers, period. and where are the workers' voices in these negotiations so far, right? If you are a worker listening to this and you have been invited to contribute to these negotiations, please let me know. You would be really hard pressed to find one, but we're working to change that. Because we think that we have a right to know what's being proposed in our name. And we also think we have a right to shape these proposals, right? There should be a democratic process. And there's definitely not a democratic process when our democratically elected officials, our congresspeople, are not even included.
Well, as with other free trade agreements, the U.S. labor movement is making nice with the administration, at least not at the beginning of these discussions, at least not outright opposing IPEF in these early stages. How do you expect this battle to play out?
Well, the hope is that the administration will hear our collective demands and do the right thing by working people in the environment. Again, the president has said repeatedly that he hopes to shape trade so that it works for working people. And because he's fulfilled some promises to labor already, we're hoping that he stands by his word with IPEF as well. However, you know, I will say Oregon remembers and still feels the impact of NAFTA. Hundreds of organizations and thousands of people organized against the TPP, and we won. So we're watching IPEF as it develops. We're organizing, and we are making the commitment that we will always show up and fight for working people everywhere.
Great. Well, finally, I just wanted to ask you about the struggle around IPEF impacting the growing aggressiveness of the U.S. administration toward China. I mean, clearly China is being excluded. China is being challenged by IPEF. And just generally the impact of IPEF on the rivalries within the world capitalist system.
Jamie, there is so much that we could say about this, and we have so limited time here. Okay. So I'll suggest that you bring me back for a part two. what I'll say right now, though, because especially, you know, this is labor radio, we should be asking ourselves, why has the conversation about trade and the economy And our livelihoods and other such policies in the past decade been centered around beating these other countries rather than about bettering the conditions for working people. There's a fundamental question about who stands to win and who stands to lose in these battles for economic domination, right? We've been talking about NAFTA and how workers on both sides of the border lost. The same is true here. And the global working class, or however you choose to define the rest of us who are not the global elites, we are always the ones to lose out. We are always the ones paying these international fines and debts. I want to say, what good is being a supposed world superpower when our people are unable to access healthcare, unable to feed our families, unable to save for retirement? We hear time and time again that we allegedly can't even find the money to pay our teachers adequately. In this question that you're asking, I think we need to ask ourselves, like, will these continued aggressions and battles for power, right, world stage power, improve the conditions for anyone, anywhere, or will they just consolidate wealth and capital as they have before? I think it's really, really important that we remember working class people in the US, working class people all over the Asia Pacific, and that includes China too, right? Our working people everywhere are struggling to survive. The conditions just keep getting worse. And I hope to see in all of this that the international working class solidarity movement grow to provide a strong united front and collectively provide answers and solutions for all of these really difficult questions.
And we see organizing happening in all of the countries, the workers' movements within all the countries impacted by IPEF.
That's right.
Against the further degradation of conditions. So yes. How can our listeners support your efforts and how can people keep informed?
So folks can visit us at our website, which is tradejusticeedfund.org. That's ED as an education. And there you can find fact sheets and videos about IPEF to learn more. You can also find tools that will allow you to write directly to IPEF negotiators. And you can also sign up for our monthly activist briefing.